C1G, number 22B.
We come to the 4,000-year period that is symbolizing the fourth day of creation. Fourth day of creation, we repeat it for the 100th time this week, so that I'm quite sure until the end of your life will you know what is the fourth day of creation. It is the symbol of the stellar universe giving us a symbol for government, a symbol for system, a system for spiritual power. How did this idea precipitate itself on the history of the children of Israel? It brought forth a completely new period. The wilderness experience was lying behind them, and now a new period was really to be tackled, namely the enormous question, here we are in the Promised Land, who is going to rule us? Who is going to govern us? How he is going to govern us? How can we have that interrelationship which the fourth day of creation shows, the interrelationship of all the tribes? How can they get along together? Should they be all independent, or should they be one union? Should they be governed by 12 kings, or by 12 priests, or by 12 prophets, or what should govern? Now, this is most interesting, because that whole sense of government, right from the beginning, has within itself the nucleus that actually only a theocratic government is possible for a people like the Jews, who had a spiritual ideal and who were led by a spiritual concept of God. But the people were not prepared to take on such a terrific high model of government, like a theocratic model of government, and so at the beginning they disliked it. When Samuel was trying to be, so to say, the theocratic exponent of Israel, Israel disliked it. They said, well, all the other people have such wonderful kings, and they have such a wonderful headquarter, and all the beauty and the gold and the silver and the horses and the chariots that go with it. This is really impressive. And we should have also an impressive government so that the foreign people really would feel we are somebody. So they yearned for a king and asked for a king. And naturally that was no good at all. It didn't work out very well. And finally they were brought into subjected to foreign nations, brought into first into Assyrian captivity, Israel, and then Judah into the Babylonian captivity. The temple was sacked. All the people were taken away from the land and brought into the foreign land along the Euphrates. And only then, really, Israel rose to the heights of her spiritual power and insight. There, the great prophets were born. There, the great prophets were writing. There, the great prophets were writing the priestly document. And that brought them home again to their homeland. They could rebuild the temple and so were reinstituted in their land. This is a big, big problem, a terrific, great problem, a problem that does not only concern the Jewish people of the first 1,000 years before Christ. It's a problem that is universal, that concerns every one of us. The greatest problem we still have today, everywhere, be it in a nation, be it in a religion, be it in a business firm, how to govern. So, let's see how the thousand-year periods began to work out that problem through many ups and downs. So we start out with principle as mind. You remember that starts with Samuel and the book that came before Samuel, like Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and so on. Especially in Judges, there was always one great cry, "Give us a king." Or actually, in Judges, we find always this, that the people were doing what was right in their own sight, and the next thing they knew that they were in trouble. And then a judge would come up and put things again into order. And so from that point on, they would always again say, and they did right what was right in their own sight. But what is right in our own sight is not principle. That's personal sense. That's personal judgment. And so it never worked. And so finally, the time of the 4,000-year period rose up with Samuel, and he was the first prophet of the Jewish people. And Samuel had a different sense. He didn't say, "I do that what is right in my own eye." He had the very opposite sense. He submitted himself constantly to the ruling principle. And right as a boy, he would say, "Well, here I am, use me, do with me what you, God, want me to do." And so he became the first prophet of Israel, but also the first and practically the only theocratic government of Israel. So prophecy ruled Israel. The revelation of the idea of principle began to rule Israel. And it was a good rule until the people cried and said again to Samuel, "Give us a king. We want a king." And it is one of the most impressive statements, I think, when you read that talk that Samuel gave in front of the people, where he justified what he has done. Sometimes I think it's like the Gettysburg Address that is so important for the whole nation here in America, that Samuel gave such a kind of a statement of what he considered true government, and he justified with what he was doing, and gave them a terrific picture what would happen to them if they would choose a king. That they were bringing themselves into bondage if they were choosing a king. And told them what would happen. If you have once time, just read that chapter where Samuel delivered that speech. But as it usually is in such a case, the people did not listen. They didn't believe. They didn't believe that a prophet could be right. They didn't believe that a spiritual idea could be right. So they wanted the human aspect of government, a king. And like Mrs. Eddy, when the people yearned to have a church again in 1892, she said, "Nothing doing. If you do that, you will be always sorry about it." And then they didn't listen. She said, "All right, you can have it. You can have it. But you must be aware what you get." And since then, really, we have got something similar to what the Jewish people got at that point. They got a king. first soul. He was made king round about the year 1000 BC. And so at that point we can see that the whole thing went wrong. So what is our first point here in principle as mind? In the first day of creation, principle as mind said, let there be lights in the firmament, let them be for signs and seasons and days and years, let there be a system of ideas governing. And that is actually what Samuel tried to bring out in his government. So we had the reign first of Samuel as a theocratic government, a prophetic government, where the vision of an individual who knew something about God's principle was ruling the country. But then the cry, let us have a king, was answered that Samuel gave them Saul, and Saul was a mighty, monstrous king. He was one head bigger than all the other rest and all the other people. Really gave a sense of the monstrosity of a king, of a personal dictatorship, of the personal kingship, and really Saul was ruling in a very personal way, constantly fighting his opponents, fighting David. And so Samuel said, all right, now I give you another king. In all quietness, nobody knew anything about it, he went and made little David, the smallest of the smallest tribe, the smallest of the smallest family, did he make king. And we can see how David now was taking up that kingship from a spiritual standpoint, not from an outward standpoint. So we get to the tone of principle as spirit, because at that point we see the kingship of David. He was king without being king. He was king being chased by Saul, though he was anointed king, but persecuted by Saul. He had constantly to hide himself in caves and so on. And he never took any opportunity to kill Saul. He had many opportunities where he could have killed Saul, but he didn't. So he brought out really that government, true government, spiritual government, is not against somebody, but always supporting every idea and acknowledging always every idea as being an instrument of principle and an instrument of God. So he never touched Saul. He did what the second record of creation did. He let Saul destroy himself. So his hands were clean. He could in this way unite those two realms in Israel, namely Judah and Israel. Judah was the southern kingdom, with Israel as a capital, and it represented always the male sense of the tribes of Israel, and the other part was Israel, more the female qualities, namely they were mostly Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and constituted the northern kingdom. But they were always divided. And David was the very first one, and practically the only one, that could unite the male and the female qualities to Israel and Judah. And so he brought all the tribes of Israel under one government. And you can see what is brought out here, that if we really see that every idea is a spiritual idea, and that we always value every idea as a necessary idea and don't fight against something, that then we can really gather together all these ideas into one government. Under David, really, we had that united kingdom of the 12 tribes, and also under his son Salomo. But after him, that the kingdom split apart again and never was united anymore. We have the division of the kingdom. So, at the point of principle as soul, we come into a quite a new period in that history. Namely, in that sense, that soul is limitless, whereas the false sense is division, separation, dividing up things into parts. And so all these, we had here Israel and Judah, no more united, but separate, and they lost their strength. The kingdom deteriorated. It was demoralized. There was no more a thinker, no more a visionary, no more a prophet that was ruling. The kings were ruling, and they were weak, and they were rotten. And so you have a whole sense that that principle was no more built on soul sense, on the sinlessness of the principle. They did no more obey the commandments. They did no more obey the prophets. And so at that point, suddenly, when they were repairing a temple, they found in the walls of the temple the Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is a book which means the repetition of the law. And King Josiah, do you say Josiah? Yeah? Read that book and was so impressed by the rules of principle that were laid down there as the repetition of the Mosaic law, that at that time he ordered that this book should be read to the people, and a great spiritual reformation took place. But that was in Judah, whereas those northern tribes who did not listen to the priests, to the prophets, were taken into captivity in Assyria. Then in Judah, when they got there and they saw the Deuteronomy and began to reform, some kind of a renaissance took place, but it was too late. So when the Babylonians were really capturing the Assyrians, then the Babylonians came in and also sacked Judah and sacked the temple in Jerusalem. And even then, Judah was brought into captivity in Babylon. Now that looks very dreary. Think of it. Here was that proud spiritual nation, those 12 tribes. They all wanted to have a spiritual foundation. They all felt that they are the chosen people. They all felt that the promise was given to them to occupy the land of Canaan forever, to be fruitful and to multiply. And suddenly they saw that they were sacked, first by the Assyrians and then by the Babylonians. And one can see that it took a lot not to lose trust in their religion. It is as if, say, the Western country would be sacked by the communistic country. That's about the situation that was happening at that time. And there, in that time, really the biggest thing happened. It was a renaissance of spirituality. As the story goes and as the history shows, all the priests and the people were put into Babylonian captivity. The temple was sacked. The symbol of principle that Moses had first shown as the temple, as the tabernacle. Later on, David was building up, and Solomon building up as a super symbol of that tabernacle. All that was sacked. They lost the material center of their worship. And that was the best thing that ever happened to Israel. Because the only thing that was left to them were the scrolls, the law, and some of the prophets. And hidden under their clothes, they carried those scrolls over the Euphrates into Babylon. And now the scrolls became the center of their religion. And no more a material temple, no more a material organization. Now a book became the center of their religion. Something which is absolutely unique in any religion, except in Christian Science. It is a book religion. And at that time, really, the Jewish religion became a book religion. And so in the Babylonian captivity, they had nothing left to worship except to sit round those priests when he would read the book. And so in this way, really, the spiritual sense of the people were instructed, and they would get the instruction in principle. And that had an effect that the whole atmosphere of spiritual scientific thinking was awakened in the Jewish people, and out of that atmosphere arose the best prophets. That whale of a prophet called Ezekiel, he arose in the Babylonian captivity. And what did those priests do at that time? They wrote the priestly document, which is what? Which is rewriting the whole history of the Jewish people, right from the first record of creation, and rewriting it and rearranging it in such a way that it contained a systematic teaching. And so the priestly document united the Jehovistic, the Eloistic, and the document of Deuteronomy, and then they added their great interpretation to all the happenings. And one can always somehow recognize the priestly document in the Bible by certain characteristics. The characteristics are always that of a principle and a system. Namely, they always wrote in a stereotyped language. Well, any system is stereotyped. You cannot just be very flowery about the system. Either something is or is not. It's a stereotyped language, but it is always a systematic presentation. They use a lot of exact symbols, like numbers. They introduced as first an abstract language, which is much sharper and much clearer. They had an impersonal style, just as their God had a much more impersonal style than the old concept of a Jehovah who was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. They were always classifying everything, like, for instance, the days of creation, which is from the priestly document. They classified and the evening and the morning, the first day, and the evening and the morning, the second day, always starting, let God said, let there be, God said, let there be. Can you hear the stereotype presentation, which has a great, great advantage, namely that you begin to hear the system of it and the rule of it and the exactness of it. They were always exact in names and in dates. Everything that had to do, so to say, with a scientific approach was really the core of their writing. So, there in that Babylonian captivity, they were producing really that priestly document, which from that point on was, so to say, the cornerstone of the Bible, because they gave the days of creation. And we can see, as we do, the thousand-year periods, that they must be the cornerstone, because we see that the whole evolution of the spiritual idea would evolve according to that fundamental order of the seven. So, what seemed to be a national calamity for Israel was later shown to be the heights of their spirituality. And also, you know, through bringing all those tribes of Israel into Assyria, first through the captivity, then through Babylon into the captivity, many of them assimilated there, but still retained the Jewish religion. They were really then the fertile ground for Jesus' disciples to go over their boundary, over the Jewish boundary, into the world, to the lost sheep of Israel, and there they found hearers for their teaching. And in this way, then afterwards, the teaching of Jesus began to spread. So you can see principle as soul always would show that if we go beyond the limitations of a personal kind of principle, a kingly sense of principle, of a priestly sense of principle, into the open field of principle interpreting itself through its idea, that though humanly sometimes that seems to be a calamity, it will be of greatest blessing. Principle always blesses in an unlimited way.